Hello and welcome to the Movies You Forgot podcast with me, your host, Adam Richmond. I am the host. Joining me as ever is my co-host, my best friend, the man who is someone I really look up to and would one day hope to be just even a tenth as smart and funny and insightful as he is, but that time is some time off a ways. It is Mr. Joe Devine.
Listen, what's going on here? This is the second week in a row that you've been sort of very, very kind to me, following a bit of a dig about how I'm the co-host.
I don't understand what you're talking about. That's just how I intro the show now.
I'm just a bit I'm just a little bit suspicious. Where's this come from?
I was hoping we maybe would go for a few more episodes before you asked. Well, anyway, like whenever it happened, I think I'd been watching an episode of Taskmaster, and I realised that there's the host of that show,
Greg Davis. Wallace. Oh yeah, Greg Davis.
Greg Davis,
not Greg Wallace.
Greg Davies.
Greg Wallace is the guy who goes around the bean factory and counts the beans, isn't he?
Yeah, and says, "You're telling me, there's 1,000 beans in each tin of beans." And I've been watching Taskmaster for many years, predating us recording this podcast.
Sure,
I was watching it in the afternoon, and the famed iconic relationship that he has with his assistant Alex Horn, who created the show. The big joke is Greg treats Alex really badly
with disdain.
That's the joke.
Yeah,
and I thought, well, hang on a sec. That's just what I've been doing to Joe for 50 episodes, calling him a leaky bucket boy.
Disdain for my bucket,
for your inability to remember things, but also I was doing the leaky bucket thing because it was I'd said it once, and then but really you hadn't shown any leaky bucket tendencies for quite some time. So then for anyone else, it may be someone who just comes in listening at episode 40, is like, why is he calling him a leaky bucket boy?
Right.
So then I watched that, and then I felt quite derivative and quite shameful. And I just thought, there's so much negativity in the world, and I just need to support my co-host, you, the co-host of the show.
Wow.
And just sort of say, introduce you as I see you, you know, this really great guy who's got loads of great ideas, and just like let people know that.
Wow.
But this is the show whereby me and my best pal Joe, we chat about the movies we forgot we'd even seen in the first place. Or film, you know, sometimes people call them films. The early iterations of this podcast, it was originally called the Films You've Forgot podcast. Just a little Easter egg for anyone who's joining us right now. But Joe had a great idea about 15 episodes in to say movies, people like movies, let's call them movies.
That's just one of my great ideas.
I think we should
change it back to films.
Stuck now. We're stuck with the premise. The problem with that premise is that it slightly is, you know, puts us in a little bit of a cul-de-sac. And on today's episode, we're doing a film that for me to call a movie I forgot is going to get me tarred and feathered and run out of town by my cineast friends. And there is no way in good conscience that I could even host this episode. I'm not actually going to do that. I'm stepping down. This is a rare time where Joe gets to host the episode because he forgot this.
Yeah.
I don't know how he fucking forgot it.
I only watched it twice a long time ago.
Well, there you go. There's the answer.
That's how.
I'm gonna read out the letterboxed, and then Joe is gonna drive this puppy to completion.
Wow. That's what I love to do every time I go to Battersea Dogs Home, by the way.
It is the letterboxed for Pulp Fiction. The Quentin Tarantino directed and scripted 1994 flick. 154 mins. That flies by. It flies by. Yeah. Especially when you watch it in three chunks, which some people might do.
I did.
You won't know the facts until you've seen the fiction. That is no tagline that I recollect being attached to this film at all.
No.
But that's what it says on Letterboxd in caps. Right. This is already, this is making me, oh Jesus.
Are you prickling?
I'm prickling.
Yeah.
A burger-loving hitman, his philosophical partner, a drug-addled gangster's moll, and a washed-up boxer.
Sorry, a drug-addled gangster's what?
Moll.
Moll?
Do you know what the word moll is? A moll?
Is it spelled M-O-L-L?
Yeah.
No, what's that?
Well, it's old-timey word for girlfriend.
A moll?
Just moll.
I've never heard that before. Is it short for like a molly or something, or is it...
Don't ask me that. I don't know that.
Let me look up the etymology of moll.
You do that and I'll finish the Letterboxd.
Okay.
And a washed-up boxer converge in this sprawling comedic crime caper. Their adventures unfurl in three stories that ingeniously trip back and forth in time. And
moll.
That is the Letterboxd.
Moll. It's got two definitions on Google. The first is a gangster's female companion. So very specific to this. I'd rush the money over to his moll, gangster's female companion. Two, a prostitute.
We say sex worker these days.
Well, I know we say that, but Google has said, the definition here says prostitute, which is why I'm reading it. It was high in use of mentions in the 1800s, pretty low these days, but early 17th century it was a pet form of the name given the given name Mary. So there you go, a Mary, a moll. Never heard that before.
It stars John Travolta as Vincent Vega, the burger loving hitman. I mean, I've never ever seen Vincent Vega described as a burger loving hitman. Heroin loving hitman, maybe.
Yeah.
More importantly,
he loves that H.
Samuel L. Jackson is Jules. Uma Thurman is Mia, the gangster's moll. Bruce Willis is the boxer Butch.
I think now we know the definition gangster's moll is much like saying safe haven, because the moll presupposes that, you know, she's attached to a gangster. So you don't need to say gangster's moll. You can just say moll.
Absolutely.
I thought you'd like that.
I love that. Ving Rhames plays Marcellus, the gangster. Harvey Keitel pops up as the wolf.
Sorry to interrupt you again. Is that Ving from the Tom Cruise movies?
He's Luther.
Oh, I knew I recognised him from somewhere. That's Luther from Mission Impossible.
This was his big cinema moment. He was a theatre actor before this.
Delightful.
Well, I think maybe he'd popped up in movies, but this was, he was renowned more for theatre.
Right, right.
And this made him big time. It made a lot of actors big time in this. Tim Roth plays Pumpkin. Amanda Plummer is Honey Bunny. So, yeah, that's it. It's one of the defining flicks of the 1990s. One of the most, at the time, influential films of its age.
It made
Quentin Tarantino's career, gave him a blank checkbook to do ever what he wanted. It gave Miramax, who produced the film, a ton of money and, I guess, critical heft to then also do whatever they wanted. And so, yeah, that's the idea that any of that could be forgot, you forgot. It's not on my head. This is on Joe's head. Don't come at me, okay?
Right. Yeah. Who do you think is going to come at you?
Just people on Letterboxd who I've come to really respect.
One of the five people who've been talking to you on Letterboxd. You think they're going to come at you?
No, it'll all be fun. And I'll go, oh, Joe's a cunt, isn't he? And they'll go, yeah, Joe's a cunt, Joe's a cunt, Joe's a cunt.
What? How lucky we are to be attached to this guy so we can talk about a film we all love.
Yeah, the C word. This is really poor form. A little bit of business, a little bit of admin business from my wife.
Based on the C word?
Based on the C word.
Oh, from your wife?
From my wife.
Yeah, get her, get her.
Oh, yeah. No, sorry. She's not the C word in question.
It just sounded so funny, though. It sounded like you were saying, oh, yeah, cunt, that reminds me of my wife. Let me just...
she hasn't listened to the podcast in ages, and the King's Speech had come out, and I know she'd seen that, and I was very pleased with that episode, and I said, "Oh, the King's Speech episode's out. You haven't listened for a while." And she said, "Oh, I don't listen to podcasts much. But yeah, okay, I'll listen to that." And she WhatsApped me when I was at work. And here's what I got. "Listening to the King's Speech, so funny. Use of the word cunt. Princess Diana jokes." And then she said, "So good. Did you edit this one?" I don't know why she asked that. And I said, "No, Joe did." And I told her there's a giveaway to tell who edits which episode. I'm not going to say it here now, but there's a little trick. There's a little trick you can to figure out who edits what.
Is it that it sounds good?
Yeah, it sounds good. I say more in your episodes because you don't fucking edit them out. In my episodes, I edit. Otherwise, ums are gone.
You're a sort of self-reflective pruner, and I'm a let him be himself.
And then she says, "I think there's a technical difference between a stutter and a stammer. One is the beginning of a word, penguin, and one is the middle of the word." So she's instantly just going straight into criticism. "Also, you both missed the point about the Colin Firth scene." And she means the scene where he gets out of the lake in Pride and Prejudice. "It's not that it's racy, but that it's a moment of pure sexual connection after all that build-up of her hating him and then suddenly seeing him in a different light." Her being Lizzie Bennet. "Seeing him in a different light as a considerate, rich, sexy guy. And because in those times you had to be proper and polite, but underneath the surface was the simmering sexual frisson."
I watched it
a few months ago and it was electrifying as ever. "By the way, I think it's highly unlikely I'll go to that gig tonight. If I'd go, I'd go if it was in Brixton." Oh, and that's something else. And then we get him back. And then I sort of said, "I'll read your comments. That is what made him famous though. And women did get juiced up from it and how sexy it was." And then she said, "It is sexy in the same way that a whole tit isn't necessarily more sexy than seeing some cleavage. It's what it hints at."
Good point.
So there we go.
Oh, I love it when wives get involved. It's my favourite. Because I want more people to be in the conversation. Like, you know, get her on the show. Bring her in more, you know. And don't make her listen to any more episodes, because if I was her, I wouldn't listen either.
Well, it's just, there was like one, maybe two compliments and then just a litany of... Have you thought about this, this, and this?
That's true, but do you want to hear what my wife said about the episode last week?
I'd love to.
She didn't say anything because she didn't listen to it, and she never listens to any of them. So, you know, yours is better.
I saw Pulp Fiction on video when it came out on video. I was a bit too young to see it at the cinema, but I was in my burgeoning cineast mode.
Yeah.
So, you know, when that hit video, it was a big deal.
And back in the day, that would have been what, 1999 or something. 5 years later.
That's it. Maybe 1997 even. It might have been 2 years later. How old would I have been? If it's 1990, it would have been 1996. So I would have been 15.
That's quite young, I would say, to watch this film.
Well, yeah, there's some tough scenes, but I'd already seen Reservoir Dogs.
Right.
So I knew, yeah, this is my guy.
I don't think there's any flagrant sexual assault in Reservoir Dogs, is there?
Nope.
No.
There isn't.
Do you think you'd ever seen something like that scene before? And by that scene, I'm referring to... What's the name of Luther, the actor Luther?
Ving Rhames.
Ving Rhames.
The character's called Marcellus.
Yeah, the character of Marcellus, Ving Rhames being, you know, brutally...
anally raped, buggered by some hillbillies in Los Angeles. I had seen that because I'd seen Deliverance.
Right, I was just thinking that when you said hillbillies, yeah. It's a bit reminiscent of Deliverance, isn't it?
It is. It's not. It doesn't hit hard as Deliverance. That the scene in Deliverance is horrifying. Hence, I've never rewatched that because I don't need that in my life. Powerful,
no.
Powerful stuff. Have you ever seen? Have you seen Deliverance?
I have seen it. Yeah, I watched it. Yeah, I don't know. Do you know? I don't want to drag us forward or anything. but I'll say this as a precursor, and you can pick it up later if you want to. I watched Deliverance probably as a teenager, maybe as a, you know, 18, something like that, and it made sort of next to no impression on me, I would have thought. I watched Pulp Fiction in two or three parts, maybe two with my wife, the last sort of, you know, the last act this evening on my own. And I've seen this film two or three times before. The violence this time...
At what ages, sorry?
Probably for the first time at around, not dissimilar to you, around 16, I would have thought. Then I would have watched it again not long after that, maybe before I was 20. Definitely seen it in my 20s at some point, but it's probably been 10 years since I've watched this film. And
likewise.
It wasn't too much for me, but I didn't enjoy the violence. And there were times in the film where I thought, I don't want to watch this. And I think that's the new thing that's happened to me in the last couple of years. And I'd be happy to explore that with you, I think, because I think that can happen to people. I think that's not just me that happens to, you know. It's like water off a duck's back when you're when you're a bit younger, you know, you're a bit cold-blooded about it. Now that I'm older and that I have love and that I care about people, I watch that and I feel sad watching. I don't want to watch it. So I was interested to see that impacted me very differently than it would have done 10 years ago.
I've seen this film, like, back in the day. I would have watched it a fair few times. And I think the reason why I hadn't seen it in over 10 years probably is because I think I just knew it so, so well.
Yeah.
Read the screenplay. And I read the screenplay before I did my rewatch. No big deal. I've got Reservoir Dogs screenplay. I've got the True Romance screenplay. His scripts are fantastic. But the memory of that scene of Marcellus and Butch in the kind of shop dungeon, and then Marcellus getting dragged off, getting chosen, and then the gimp being pulled out. It's always, the idea of it is always worse, I think, than whenever I've watched it. It's very queasy, but it's very well done, and it's not overly
gratuitous
or turns your stomach. He spares the audience a bit of, you know, maybe I'm just inured to it because I know it so well, and you know Marcellus is going to get saved. I always find it quite interesting that Butch, played by Bruce Willis, he escapes and he's gonna leave whilst Marcellus is being assaulted, and he can't do that. He's going to go back and save this guy, but he takes his time choosing which weapon he's going to go down there with. Like, and you're watching it thinking, these are, you know, get down there quicker. But Butch, it's a really interesting insight to the character. It's a great character moment. It's like Butch is going to save him, but he's going to save him on his own terms. He wants to wait until he gets a samurai sword.
Yeah.
Rather than really get down there and end Marcellus's torture.
Well, that scene is shot for kind of laughs as well, because it's not just that he finds a samurai sword, it's that it's the fourth thing he sees in a string of things that are all more deadly than the last thing. And it's totally played for laughs. That meanwhile, the sounds of a man being raped downstairs are, you know, coming through the ceiling.
I don't know. I just, the violence, it's interesting you say about violence. Tarantino, he's always got it in the neck for his approach to violence. Do you want to hear Quentin Tarantino and what he says about violence?
I do.
Because I've got it in various forewords of my screenplays.
In various different forewords.
In different forewords, it's like, yeah, I know what he says about violence, and I can tell you what he says about it.
I love that you say forewords. I'm sure that's right. I say forward.
Forward. Forewords.
You say forewords. I say forwards.
Well, no, I've never pluralized forewords. Forwards,
right?
So I've always said the forward. I'm reading the forward.
What would you call it? Would you call it a preface?
Preface, yeah, not really.
Or a preface.
Preface.
I say preface.
Preface. Preface.
And sometimes I say, let me preface this by saying, yeah, I'll even say that, you know, which is admittedly unnecessary.
You're Mr. Preface. Everything you do is a preface.
I can't escape the preface.
You will start speaking and then you'll go, well, let me just preface this with a very, very long anecdote,
yeah,
about a horse with a giant penis.
And then people are saying, where's the meat? I thought, when do we get to the meat of the matter? And I say, there's no meat. It's all, what's the little dishes they bring around? What are those called?
Amuse-bouche.
No, there's a different term for them, isn't there? What is it? Little canapes. It's all canapes with me. It's the fun, isn't it? It's like I'm the sort of person you meet in the pub and then you get chatting to for like half an hour. Or maybe you have a great one night, you know, and there's like lots of, that guy's full of stories, full of fun, isn't he? And then you meet me again and it's the same thing. And then you start to go, oh, there's nothing here. there's no center. It's just all canopies, prefaces, amuse-bouche, you know. It's amusing bouche, but it's all amuse-bouche, yeah? Where's the meat? There's no meat. There's no substance, you know. It's just a balloon.
I don't take the violence very seriously. I find violence very funny, especially in the stories that I've been telling recently. Violence is part of this world, and I'm drawn to the outrageousness of real-life violence. It isn't about people luring people from helicopters onto speeding trains, or about terrorists hijacking something or other. Real-life violence is, you're in a restaurant and a man and his wife are having an argument, and all of a sudden that guy gets so mad at her, he picks up a fork and stabs her in the face. That's really crazy and comic bookish, but it also happens.
Does it?
That's how real, it does in Quentin Tarantino's world. That's how real violence comes kicking and screaming into your perspective in real life. I'm interested in the act, in the explosion, and in the entire aftermath of that. What do we do after this? Do we beat the guy up who stabbed the woman? Do we separate them? Do we call the cops? Do we ask for our money back because our meal has been ruined? I'm interested in answering all of those questions.
Doesn't he just call the police?
When not necessarily. Some people would be in freeze mode. Some people would just run away. Some people would just go, I can't handle this.
Oh, I'm not saying that's what everyone would do. I'm just saying the answer to that is simple, isn't it? It's call the police.
You were on a tube with a woman smoking a doobie, yeah. And you couldn't even say no.
Yeah, but if she stabbed someone in the face with a fork, I would have called the police.
Would you though?
I don't
think you
know.
Would.
I
think
you're so polite. Just left the tube. She would have said, "Is this okay? Are the forks still sticking out of his face?" And he's crying in agony. And I go, "Yeah, it's fine, it's fine, it's fine." Just to be clear, like, I don't think there's any moral problem with violence being used in films like this. I think in most of these cases, like, if I'm not into it, it's my decision not to watch it or to watch it, right? But I was just surprised as it related to this film, because I've obviously seen it before. I've seen all of Quentin Tarantino's films, and most of the time, violence, gratuitous or not, and complicated, difficult themes, you know, they are to me like water off a duck's back. But recently, that's not the case anymore. Now I feel differently about it. And I think it's because you know, now I'm older and I'm married and I have a great marriage, and I understand my marriage and I understand the dynamics of these intense relationships, and I've done a lot of therapy and I'm able to be reflective on my relationships with other people. When I watch a film now, unlike when I was maybe in my early 20s and I didn't have quite an appreciation of these things, these themes, now when I watch a film, I look at the character of Marcellus, for example, in Pulp Fiction, when he's being, you know, brutally sexually assaulted, and because I have my own experiences of relationships, and I'm able to empathize with characters in films in a way that I couldn't when I was in my 20s. And now I imagine that he has the same feelings that I have, or that my wife has, or that he's got, you know, he's in a relationship with Uma Thurman, and where's she and what's she thinking about it? Or Bruce Willis's character, he just wants to get back to his
his girlfriend, they're running away together and the stakes are really high, but he's going to stay. And so I think I'm just better able to connect with the characters. And when you connect with the characters in these films, the violence is really unpleasant. It is really horrible because it feels more real somehow, you know? And particularly in a film like this where I suppose, you know, like as Quentin Tarantino said, he's interested in real life violence, not someone, you know, dropping down from a helicopter onto a moving train, but something that is feasible, something that could happen. It's just quite affecting, I think. And I didn't love it. I don't mind someone's head getting shot off, but like the torture is unpleasant to me now. So I think I would think twice about what mood I was in, how I was feeling before I watched this film again. And there's the violence in the language as well. I think it is, in this film, it's a little different to in some other Tarantino films, and maybe this is a conversation that we will have, but Tarantino, when he acts in Pulp Fiction, his character, one of the things I don't like about it is that it suddenly feels like the fourth wall is entirely broken and I'm watching the writer, director saying lines that he wrote for himself. The violence of his lines in the film, like, that's also unpleasant to watch and to listen to. And so it's not just about the actual aggressive, like, physical violence. I think there's other forms of violence in the film as well, which are a bit, like, tension-creating.
Well, his... Eric Stoltz plays John Travolta's drug dealer, Lance, and he said... Tarantino said to Eric Stoltz, you can play... There are two characters and they both wear bathrobes. Take your pick. And so the only reason Tarantino's plays Jimmy in the third story is because Eric Stoltz chose to play Lance in the first story. That's a little fun. Is that a little fun tidbit?
That is a fun tidbit. I like it, yeah.
Yeah, Tarantino is His first introduction, where he's berating Samuel L. Jackson and using the N-word, is excruciating.
It's so uncomfortable, Adam.
It's him trying to be a badass.
Yeah.
And you just imagine that Samuel L. Jackson's character in that film, in that world,
yeah,
wouldn't put up with it for a second.
No.
But then as the sequence goes on and Jimmy then becomes... he's more in the background, and then he's just more of a goofy nerd who is bowing and scraping to Mr. Wolf. That fits Tarantino's acting, very, very thin acting range, just about,
yeah,
fine. It's still distracting, but it's the first clang, that initial clang on the bell. It's so...
Oh, God.
Ugh.
It's awful. And I was going to add to that as well. I think that's a fair reading. He does improve as those scenes go on. But... not only is it extremely uncomfortable to watch him using that word and you know, playing this character that doesn't really make sense within the world he's designed himself, but also I think the worst thing about him is that he knows what good acting looks like, and he knows how to do an impression of that. So in some ways, he's not a terrible actor because he's doing some of the work. I can see that what he's trying to do in his head is amazing. And if he was able to do it, it would be perfect for the role. Like, so he's got like the intellectual element of it down. Unfortunately, he has no talent, right? He is not a good actor. He is a bad actor. He has no physical acting talent whatsoever. It's horrendous to watch. It's worse to watch someone that sort of knows what they're doing a bit, but is still shit at it. It's better to watch someone that's completely oblivious, you know, is the worst actor in the world and has no idea what they're doing. I think those people are more watchable than what Quentin Tarantino does in this film. I hate it. I hate it so much. And yeah, for sure, like the racist language makes it a lot harder and probably like, you know, formalizes my opinion about it. But for me, that he shows up in it, it kind of ruins the whole third act of the film. Like, it's a proper marks down for me if I was reviewing it out of 10. Like, that he's in it is losing the film at least one point, maybe two.
Bonjour. Nice sweater.
What I really liked about rewatching this film, and it had dulled in my mind, was I realised that all the main characters, Mia, played by Uma Thurman, Vincent Vega, John Travolta, Butch, played by Bruce Willis, they're all actually really horrible people. Yep. And they're deeply unlikable. Jules is, played by Samuel L. Jackson, is the most likable, and that might just be because of Samuel L. Jackson.
Maybe. And because he has a redemptive path, right?
And that is supposedly what Pulp Fiction is about redemption. But I was watching it, and I really liked how Tarantino he's kind of unapologetic. He doesn't write characters. He doesn't want to be liked. He doesn't want you to like them and be their friend. Vincent Vega he's an arsehole. He's a dickhead. He's really thin-skinned.
Yeah.
Mia is a bore. She's really boring and very self-involved and hugely into cocaine.
Yes. And completely morally compromised as well.
Yeah. And Butch is an abusive partner and a horrible cunt.
Yeah.
And there are little moments where each of those characters have a moment that humanizes them and you feel something for them. And I like the fact that he writes characters and he doesn't try and make you like them. Most, modern films always try and make likable characters. And at this point in Tarantino's career, he is uninterested in that, and I liked that about it. How did you get me onto this? Quentin Tarantino plays Jimmy on the page. He's one of these other deeply unlikable characters. He's immediately unlikable. But if you get a character, if you get the right actor, the right charismatic actor to play that role, the scene would work, right?
Yeah.
Because all the Butch works. So who would we get?
Of the time?
Yeah, of the time. Steve Buscemi.
Probably someone like Steve Buscemi. That's a good shout, yeah. And Steve Buscemi would be able to pull off all of those lines, right, in a way that felt unlikable and watchable at the same time. I mean, you already said it. Anyone else would be fine. Like, literally any professional actor would be fine. And I don't begrudge Quentin Tarantino for writing himself into his own films. If I were in his position, I would do the same thing. I think, go for it. It's totally his decision. It's completely his right. You just have to accept, though, that it makes the film much worse than it otherwise would have been.
It's the same with Django Unchained when he pops up in that towards it in the fourth act.
Yep.
It's horrendous, and it already feels like you want that film to end, and then he turns up.
Which completely breaks the fourth wall.
Yeah, because you're looking, it's like, oh, this is the director and he's in the movie and I'm not watching him. I've been reminded I'm watching a movie. I was in Fantasyland before.
That's what's so selfish about it. I was in Fantasyland because this film's great. The actors are great. The performances have really drawn me in. The story is compelling. I'm at this point, I'm hooked by the stakes. And guess what? It's always at the point where you're deepest in the story and you really want to know what happens. Fucking Quentin Tarantino shows up and reminds you exactly where you are and reminds you why you started watching a film in the first place and what you were trying to forget from your real life. And all you are left with is to be flooded with feelings and thoughts about what Quentin Tarantino must think is going to happen by putting himself here in front of me in this moment. Like, what level of desperation is required for you to be this person? Fuck, man. No wonder everybody hates him, right? Just don't do it. It's so simple. Or do it. I mean, it's obviously up to him. I don't care.
I mean, it's obviously an important part of his psyche, and without it, these films wouldn't even exist. It's like what they used to say about Wayne Rooney. If you take that aggression out of his game, you take those red cards out of his game, he's a different player. He's not the player that that you want.
That's a really good football analogy. I'm laughing because it's sort of from 20 years ago, but it's funny.
Do you want to talk about postmodernism?
I mean, I always want to talk about postmodernism, who doesn't? Every time I leave the house, someone comes up to me on the street and says, hey, you want to talk about postmodernism? And I say, yeah. And then the next person I see, I say, do you want to talk about postmodernism? And they say, I was already talking about postmodernism with this person. And they introduce me. And then we all talk about postmodernism together. And no one ever gets anything done, It's very postmodern.
I myself don't have anything particularly fresh to say about postmodernism. I kind of have a notion of what it is, and I'll lob the word around. But I do have Mark Cousins's The Story of Film book on my shelf. And he talks about gangster films right towards the end. It's a superb book, and it's also a great documentary that you can get. He did it for the BBC. It's like 15 episodes. He goes from the start of cinema right up to the modern day.
Right.
And so he's talked a bit about Goodfellas, and then he goes, Pulp Fiction, another gangster film of the 90s, took Scorsese's experiments with postmodernism so much further that it became one of the most influential films of the decade. And he talks about how Vincent and Jules talk about foot massages and how they talk. The scene from the beginning where they're chatting, where they're going on the way to kill people, but they are chatting about foot massages and the like. But he says, such scenes are familiar from hundreds of crime B-movies and film noirs from the USA in the late 1940s and 1950s. The killers typically talk tersely, if at all. They are functions of the plot. Here, however, and this reveals how 1990s postmodern cinema transformed the movies that inspired it, they converse as follows. And then he gives the little foot massage speech. Blah, blah, blah.
Which, for anyone who hasn't, I mean, for people listening who haven't seen Pulp Fiction, in short, that speech is a sort of moral, ethical conversation between two characters about whether a foot massage constitutes some kind of cheating. Is it like, you know, the argument given is like, okay, you don't think it's bad to give a married woman a foot massage. Would you give a man a foot massage? And the character's like, no, I wouldn't. It's like, well, there you go then. You know, there's something there. It might not be full sex, but there's something there.
Borrowing a phrase from Scorsese about the 1970s, it opened up the world of US genre cinema to feminized disquisition. I don't really know what Cousins means by
feminized disquisition.
Yeah.
I'll look that up.
Pulp Fiction was full of such digressions and atypical discussions in minutiae. One critic commented that in films such as Pulp Fiction, the verbal set pieces take precedence over the action set piece. The effect became known as Tarantino-esque. And the Tarantino-esque of it all is violent men talking about like very mundane or pop culture-y things. He did it loads in Reservoir Dogs, and it was ripped off so much in the late 90s and early 2000s, but no one could do it as well as him.
Feminize just means to make
female
or something, you know, associated with women. Disquisition is an essay, so feminized disquisition, I guess, is to maybe be intellectual or academic about making something more woman.
I guess Cousins is suggesting that the art of conversation is more feminine than the 1940s, 50s.
The vulnerability they show.
I guess there's the masculinity of not speaking, and feminized is more...
They're chatty.
Chatty, conversational.
Right. He just thinks they're more like women because they're chatting.
I think he's talking about types, right? He's not saying women chat more than men. Men chat loads.
Right.
But men on screen, and these kinds of violent men, would be men of few words. They wouldn't be chatting about foot massages and, you know, what you call a quarter pounder of cheese.
Sure.
In Belgium.
Yeah, yeah.
They would be saying nothing.
Right.
I think that's what he's saying.
Whereas the women would just be chatting constantly. I mean, I do think Pulp Fiction is, you know, the epitome of a postmodern film, though. And I want to pick up on something we were just talking about so as to ensure that your wife doesn't send us another text saying, you've missed the point again, which I'm I'm now going to constantly have in the back of my head whenever I'm talking. Not only is the film postmodern because, like you've said already, these two characters who in previous eras would be stern, brutish, quiet men who were you wouldn't even know if they were contemplative, you know, you would just think they're just their functions of the plot, as that quote that you read out says, right? Instead, they're talking about burgers and they're having, you know, reflective conversations on, in theory, the meaning of life, right? So you have all of that. You also have the fact that the timeline of the film is broken up in a really interesting way. It's something I actually like about the film. I think it's done really well. There are lots of films where I don't enjoy that kind of messing around, and we've talked about Memento a lot on this podcast before, and I know it's one of your favourites. I'm not a huge fan of, you know, of films that mess around hugely with the sense of time, but I really like the way it's done in Pulp Fiction and how these scenes intertwine with each other across the course of the film.
Well, yeah, he's doing that because he wants to ape structures of books, really, and that's why he always talks about, like, why can't a film have the same sort of structure as a book? And it isn't so much of a formal exercise as opposed to him sort of saying, what's the most impactful way to tell this story? And in Pulp Fiction, it doesn't feel like an exercise in clever. It all just works really nicely. And
it is really clever, because I think if you put that film in order, it's really boring. And like the stakes don't make sense, and I'm not invested. Whereas the way that it's presented is really interesting. You've hit upon the final point though as well there, right? Which is that the film is referential not just to books in the case that you were saying, but also to other films, right? We've already mentioned a couple of things that have been taken from other films. I read earlier that the briefcase, which I guess is the MacGuffin, is that right, Adam? It's the MacGuffin.
I mean, in any other, in another version of this film, it would be. It's not. I guess it is.
It doesn't have all the functions of the MacGuffin, but it's, you know.
But it's
a postmodern MacGuffin.
Yeah, it drives an element of Jules and Vincent's story. You know what they're after.
You could describe it as a satire of a MacGuffin, which is quite a postmodern thing. And also, he's borrowed that, or is paying loving homage, as the article I read said, to a Hitchcock film where there's also a MacGuffin briefcase that you never find out the contents of, but it glows gold when you open it. Right. So that's taken from another film. There are other elements of this that are taken from elsewhere, and again, pay homage to. And then the very fact that I was just complaining loudly about Quentin Tarantino himself, the director, being in the film and that breaking the fourth wall, that's also a very postmodern thing to do. So I think when you put all of those things together, it is a super postmodern film. And if I was in 1994 watching it, the first thing I said to my wife when we put it on the other day and watched the opening scene, which is such a great opening scene, and also the performances in the city, they're just fantastic with the two characters who are going to rob this diner, this restaurant. It's brilliant. And, you know, watching that, I was so excited. The way it builds the tension up, and then Honey Bunny eventually stands up and says and screams, "If any of you pricks move, I'm going to execute every motherfucking last one of you." And it cuts straight to... Like, I got goosebumps watching that. I thought, if I was 18 years old in 1994 and I was in the cinema watching this film, I would think, holy shit, what is this? This is amazing. This is amazing, you know?
It's just the sheer confidence of it and the storytelling of it.
It's a superb film, you know? I probably will forget it again. But very good. Very, very good.
You know, this won the Palme d'Or.
The Palme d'Or?
The Palme d'Or in Cannes.
That's a very bad material to make a door out of, isn't it? Unless maybe you live on an island, desert island.
Mm. Door, like D apostrophe O-R.
Oh, like the Ballon d'Or.
Gold. That means gold, right?
Does it mean gold?
Gold. The Golden Palme d'Or.
The Golden Palme. Like a Midas.
A frond.
A frond. Was it Midas that turned everything into gold?
Everything he touched turned to gold.
But then he touched his family. And they turn to gold.
And then so he's got a big giant bed of gold.
Wouldn't mind that, mate. Problem? Come home some days, come home, touch your family, they turn into gold. Wouldn't mind that. Hey? Hey? Ball and chain? Hey? Ball and chain?
It was a really great episode of Neighbours.
You wouldn't get a destructive text message from a gold statue. Ball and chain?
I remember an episode of Neighbours back in university.
Yeah. That's when good neighbours become good friends.
Yeah. Toadfish, Rebecca. was heard to remark.
Toadfish.
Everything was going wrong for Toadfish Rebecca, and he was heard to remark, it's like I've got the opposite of the Midas touch.
Right.
And me and my friend, we looked at each other and we said, okay, so hang on a wait. He's got the opposite of the Midas touch. So everything he doesn't not touch doesn't not turn into base metal. Oh, what a curse. What a curse to have.
Oh, man. You were such a middle-class teenager. Look at that. Intellectualizing a funny joke. Oh.
No, we were at university.
Oh, you were at university. Right. Sorry, I just assumed you were a child based on what you were saying.
I don't know. I think that's pretty smart.
It is pretty smart. Yeah, it is pretty smart.
Tarantino said when he won the Palme d'Or, I think someone had a pop at him, and he said, I don't make movies that bring people together. I make movies that split people apart.
Right, right, yeah.
Everything I've been, like rereading the scripts, reading what he used to say back in the day.
Yeah.
And when he talks about his writing process, he is a quite inspirational character.
Right.
He's got so much great stuff to say about how he writes, and it's probably impossible to write the way he writes. But it's intuitive. He follows his heart. He follows his interests. The reason why he's self-taught, and I think when someone asked him when directing Reservoir Dogs, he's like, "How did you do this?" He's just like, "I just watched." Oh no, that's it. He met Harvey Keitel speaking about the script for Reservoir Dogs, and he goes around Keitel's house. And Keitel says, how the hell did you write this? Did you hang around gangsters and stuff? And Tarantino said, no, I've just watched loads of movies. Basically, Tarantino's watched more movies than anyone else. And anyone else who tries to do Tarantino-esque stuff, they haven't watched the source material. And that's why they've just watched the Tarantino movie.
Right.
And that's why anyone else who tries to do anything like he does, it's always shit. And it makes you, when you watch the knockoffs, like say, I don't know, anything Guy Ritchie did, like Lock, Stock or Snatch, it makes you think Tarantino's stuff was a bit shit. But it wasn't, you know?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
I know what you're saying. Yeah.
He's referencing stuff and he's got a deep, deep well to draw on. And then the people, the knockoffs and anyone else, they are just knocking off him.
Right. Yeah, I mean, probably, you know.
I think.
Yeah, it's a theory, isn't it? It is actually a theory, yeah.
It's something I thought today.
I thought you were going to go in a different direction with it, though, because when you read that quote, I don't make movies that bring people together, I make movies that split people apart. I thought you were going to say he is someone, when he talks about his own films, that is kind of a dick, you know, and like doesn't make a lot of sense. But I think that's okay. I can forgive him and other people for that, and myself for the same thing, right? I don't expect... I always think about Bob Dylan, right? You listen to Bob Dylan's early music, the 60s and the 70s, and you listen to what he's saying and singing his lyrics and the way he sings them, and you're like, holy hell, you know? This guy, he was chaining the universe. We've had this conversation before. I've told you before that his later interviews where he says he reflects on his own songwriting and says, I don't know how I did that. You know, I can't do that now, right? He separates himself from his own art, right? Let alone me sitting here twiddling my thumb, separating great artists from their own art for my own sake. He separates himself from his art. And I do that with Tarantino, because when I watch a Tarantino film, I think, oh, that's a great film. You know, that's very compelling. That's exciting. I'm enthusiastic about it. I feel stuff about it. I feel, I just love watching those movies, right? Whenever I listen to anything Quentin Tarantino says, I think, oh, shut up, man. And it's not his fault, right? You can at once be a terrific artist with a deep subconscious well and the ability to draw things together and write them down in a way that you don't even necessarily know how you've done that, right? The problem is when you start telling other people how you did it as if you know how you did it, I always call bullshit. Always call bullshit on that, because the great artists have no clue how they did it. They might be able to tell you how they created the environment in which it occurred, maybe, but they have no clue how they wrote something really great. It just happens. That's how art happens, right? So as soon as someone's ever so keen to tell me how they did it and then say things like, oh, I write films that drive people apart, shut up, you make great films. And actually, don't shut up. Feel free to say whatever you want, obviously. It's my choice to listen or not. And who the fuck am I? I don't know. I'm talking now. I should stop talking. I don't know what I'm talking about either. The whole point defeats itself, and I fully expect to get a text message from your wife saying so. But all I'm saying is just shut up.
No, but like when I talk about, when he talks about his writing, he mainly talks about his process, in that I always was struck when I was younger when he would say, when I write a script.
I thought you were going to do it in an impression then.
I was going to go,
no, try it, go on. Just throw the N-word in several times and you'll sound exactly like him.
He'd say, when I'm going to write a script, let's say I'm going to write Jackie Brown.
Yep.
A couple of notebooks, I get a couple of felt tip pens, and I say, these are the notebooks and these are the felt tip pens that I'm going to write Jackie Brown with.
Uh-huh.
And it's this kind of statement of intent. I always found it quite funny, like, he sounds like a child. He writes with felt tip pens, yeah, and not, yeah, biros.
These are my felt tip pens, yeah, and this is my notebook, and these are the pens I'm going to write in the notebook with, and I'm going to write Jackie Brown, and then my parents are going to go, oh, wow, he's a prodigy.
Right. I think that's a very unkind reading of it, but it's a writing trick to sort of say, this is what I'm going to do, and then he's kind of given himself the framework, and he sits down and he does it. He fucking, you know, he finishes the screenplay.
Yeah.
And I quite like that. And then he says he listens to the characters. He doesn't necessarily know how stuff's gonna finish. He has a framework. He has characters. For Reservoir Dogs, he just heard these voices, these kind of gangsters speaking to each other. And he just had to, you know, he channeled, not channeled, channel's a horrible word.
No, he channeled it. I think that's fine.
Channeled it.
You can be channeling your own subconscious, right? It doesn't have to be like a spiritual thing.
And I think that is why so many of his characters feel they are little versions of little parts of his personality. They are very Quentin Tarantino. Characters who are obsessed with feet.
Right.
In particular, he's got a foot obsession. He's a foot fetishist.
Right.
He's known for it. That's why they talk about foot massages. Like, when I saw that, and to this day, I don't fucking understand why they're talking about foot massages. Like, Vincent Vega says to Jules, is like, have you ever given a foot massage? And Jules is like, don't talk to me about foot massages. I'm the foot fucking master.
Yeah.
And Vincent is like, he's like, oh, you know, there's this thing about them here. They're kind of cool. They're intimate, but not too intimate. And something's going on there. And blah, 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 blah. It's like, what the fuck are you talking about?
But you know why they're talking about it, right?
Because Quentin Tarantino is obsessed with feet and likes
talking
about it.
Well, yeah, but in the plot, because...
No, I understand.
Okay, you understand that. Sorry, you made it sound like you didn't know why they were talking about them in the film.
No, I understand, but they're talking about it because he's made a character... The story is that Antoine Rocamora gave Mia a foot massage and got thrown off a balcony. No, but Quentin Tarantino wrote that bit of the script as well, Joe.
Sure. No, I understand. Right. But like a foot massage, it's just to give one alternative perspective for a moment, simply to play a mere Keanu advocate, okay? What I would say is, can you think of another thing which perfectly rides the balance between being a totally neutral thing to do to somebody else's body and then quite a sexy thing to do to somebody else's body? A back rub is too sexy. A foot rub is a foot massage is a step down from a back rub.
No, a foot rub is far sexier because there's a bare foot there.
I think that maybe
little shoulders
is just revealing about your own fetishes.
So now you're Jules and I'm Vincent.
What?
Vegas.
No, that's not what's happening. Are you saying I've got a back fetish?
No. Because then I'd be saying you're Quentin Tarantino.
He's got a foot fetish.
Yeah, no, I know he does. I told you that.
Who's got a? Have I got a back fetish? No one's got a back fetish.
No, of course not. But you're saying...
Love a good back, though.
You're saying touching a woman's neck, like the shoulders, not the bare neck, shoulders that are clothed, you're saying is more intimate than touching a bare foot.
Yeah, I think
it is.
I'm
saying touching a bare foot... Well, I disagree.
Right.
And now let's go into this room and kill these college guys right. And get the briefcase.
Yeah, okay.
What I'm saying is... I don't know what I'm saying now. You've got me massively off topic.
What about a hand massage?
I thought you were saying, what about a hand job? Jesus Christ, well, of course a hand job is more intimate. A hand massage, of course, is more intimate than a foot massage. And also a back rub.
It's more intimate than a foot massage. Surely hand would be less intimate.
I think when I said back, I really meant shoulder.
Right, you mean a shoulder grip. You mean grabbing the shoulders, right? Not a back massage.
No, you're right. Sorry. I meant stood up, shoulder massage.
What, you're both stood up?
Yes.
That's, see, no. Because if you're standing behind someone standing...
If someone's sat down and you go over and start massaging their shoulders, that's a kind of a power play and something that pervy bosses might do.
No, that is true. But if you're standing behind someone who's standing, facing away from you, and you're rubbing their shoulders and massaging them, and your front area is close to their back area, that's far sexier than them sitting down. If they're sitting down, then your front area is just near the back of their head, and that's not sexy.
My front area is not near their back area. Someone says, I've got a really tight shoulder.
Yeah.
And then you just do a little Vulcan net pinch on the... There's nothing sexy about, like, going... Just doing that little bit of gristle.
What a sad life you live. You think there's nothing sexy about doing a bit of gristle on a back.
A barefoot. This is... The point is... I've watched this film.
Yeah.
I've watched this film when I was 16.
Oh, yeah, the film.
And then from then to now, the only time I've ever given a fucking foot massage is when my wife was there.
Yeah.
Ooh, my bunions hurt.
Yeah.
Can you give me a foot massage? And I've had to clasp her cold feet and work out that, and there's nothing sexy or intimate about
no,
it.
No, but also, would you give me a barefoot massage?
If you wanted one, yes.
Come on, you'd be uncomfortable about it, wouldn't you?
Of course I'd give you a foot massage, just to prove my point.
Right.
Because I said I would, and I would.
For point proving.
Yeah.
No, fair, that counts. That counts, yeah. You don't seem like someone that would give a good foot massage.
No, because I don't want to do anything for anyone.
Right, yeah. Because it really, giving a massage, it's about willingness, isn't it? I think that's why, obviously there's the physical element of touching, but I think the sensual element of it is... There's an expression of physical desire, the desire to make somebody feel good. And when someone's giving you a little squeeze or a massage or something, you can really tell when they're not trying or when they're not really into it, when they're not pouring their sort of heart and soul into it. Do you know what I mean?
Do you like your feet getting touched?
Absolutely not.
Do you want a foot massage?
No. I accidentally once kicked my cousin in the face because she'd dripped a bit of food on my boot. I was wearing a big leather Doc Martin boot. She dripped a bit of food on it, and so she just wiped it off with a serviette. And my feet are so sensitive that through the thick leather and the serviette, I kicked her in the face by accident. It was a rollicking laugh. But no, I hate it when people touch my feet.
You say serviette, not napkin.
Well, I would say that a serviette and a napkin are two different things.
What would you say one is, and what would you say the other is?
I would say a serviette is...
Think about it.
Yeah, I'm trying to think about which way around it is. One of them is made of fibres and cloth, and one of them is paper tissue paper.
Yeah, so which was she doing, paper or cloth?
She was doing... I've said the wrong word. She was using paper, and I think that's a napkin.
Mm.
And I think a serviette is a cloth item. But then I can imagine a world in which someone said that a napkin is a cloth and a serviette is a... But they call it a napkin in Pret, don't they? They said, you want a napkin.
Shall we play the box office game?
You sounded very hesitant about that. Do you feel that you've got things left unsaid?
Well, there's low. I mean, Pulp Fiction is it's such a beast. There's so much we haven't chatted about, but I think the nature of the show is
that we do a bad job.
We have the window and we do a bad job and we talk about what we talk about.
Yeah.
Again, I imagine these imaginary listeners, and there's many of them, thinking, I can't believe they didn't talk about that.
Is that what you think they're thinking right now?
Yeah, sure. I'm thinking they're bored. They've certainly switched off, and they are thinking, oh, why didn't they talk about what would we have talked about? I mean, like, maybe everyone bangs on about the music that Tarantino uses. We didn't talk about that. That's not that interesting, I think.
That's boring.
What would we have talked about?
I think they're thinking, oh, this wasn't a very good episode. Or like, why do these guys think they're so good at this or funny? Like, why do they think they deserve to be able to do this? You know? That's what I think they're thinking.
I'm not going to listen to another one of these.
Mm.
This, because like actually I know the film Pulp Fiction because I've watched it several times, and I think they've done, they haven't even really talked about it at all. So why do they think they've, what right do they have? Who gives them the right, you know?
They didn't talk about how Danny DeVito is a quite important, played an important part in the getting it made as a producer.
Oh, that would have been so interesting if we had talked about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, we didn't.
No.
We didn't talk about
that. You didn't tell that great anecdote that you told me before we started recording about how he wrote it. It would have been interesting if you'd said that, but you didn't say that.
No, I didn't talk about how he wrote it in Amsterdam.
Right.
That
would have been interesting.
Roger Avery. Roger Avery got a story credit for the middle story, the Gold Watch, but
right,
we didn't
right.
talk about that. And
we didn't talk about Christopher Walken being in this film, who I forgot was in it. We didn't talk about that. And I even had a bit in my head about scenes where a strange adult, arrives at a house where there's just a mother and a young child, and they don't know the adult, and they're bringing information directly to the child, because there's a sort of theme of those throughout films and TV, and we didn't talk about that. That would have been good, but we didn't talk about it.
We didn't talk about that Simpsons episode, which heavily references Pulp Fiction, even including the bit where it's got Wiggum and another character. Oh, is it? It's not Skinner. It's Wiggum and another character with ball gags in their mouths.
Right,
the Simpsons.
Yeah. We didn't talk about ball gags or gimps or sex play or any of that kind of stuff. I guess we talked about feet a little bit, but that would have been interesting.
That sequence, I didn't talk about how it made me think of the Japanese horror film Audition.
Right.
And I double-checked to see if Tarantino had ripped it off. So suspicious am I of Tarantino's references. But Audition came out 4 years after Pulp Fiction, so...
Right.
Didn't talk about that. Didn't talk
No, we
about
didn't
that.
Talk about that. We didn't talk about how the famous monologue is partly taken from another movie, the biblical monologue. You know, we didn't talk about that.
I didn't even know that.
Right, well, what a shame. You would have known it if we'd talked about it, you know?
No, we didn't talk about the Oscars, about how it was up against Forrest Gump.
Oh, I would have loved that.
That would have been a great chat. He won best screenplay, and when he went up to collect it, he said, "I think this is going to be the only award I win tonight,"
right.
And it proved right. We didn't chat about that.
We didn't really chat about John Travolta at all, who I thought was great in the film.
Yeah, we did.
And I would have loved to have talked about him, because I also watched Grease the other day, and I would have talked about that.
That's such good chat.
Yeah,
that's such good chat. We didn't do it. We didn't, and we didn't talk about how we think this stands up in. In terms of influence, because it was obviously immediately influential, what the idea of influence, like it made me think of Citizen Kane, hugely influential for a certain amount of time, but then at some point, then it just does it just get absorbed into culture and then stop being influential? Like, when does influence stop and then just become?
Yeah, when does it wane and subsume?
Yeah.
I would have loved to have talked about that.
I would love to have figured that out, and we didn't bring it up.
We didn't do that. We didn't talk about the fact that Mia and Vincent didn't actually win the dance contest. Did you know that?
They've got the trophy.
I know, but there's a little Easter egg in the film later that explains why they didn't win, and it's a shame that we didn't talk about it, because you'll never know now.
We didn't talk about, there's the line of this in this film that's always bugged me is when Vincent and Mia are at Jack Rabbit Slim's on the date and they're getting to know each other, and Mia says to him, there is an uncomfortable silence. And Mia says, "Don't you hate that? Uncomfortable silences. Why do people feel the need to yak about bullshit just to feel comfortable?" Now, I never get that line, never scans for me, because she's acknowledging uncomfortable silences, but she's made it uncomfortable, and she's aware enough to make it, she could make it comfortable and sustain the silence to make it comfortable. And yet she says, "Don't you hate that? Uncomfortable silences." She's
right.
Made it uncomfortable. It has always bugged me, that line.
I think I could have explained that.
Yeah, but we didn't talk about it.
No, we didn't talk about it. And, you know, we also didn't talk about the original planned cast and who was going to play which role, which partly you told me about earlier, and partly I've been reading online. It's really interesting who they originally wanted to cast, and it would have been a very different film, and we didn't talk about it.
And so the listeners will never know.
They'll never know because there's no other way to find these things out. Like, we're very much the conduit for all of these kinds of things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you know what else we didn't talk about? We also didn't talk about Butch's cab driver. You know, it's kind of a strange character. Never really understood what part in the film she's supposed to play, what that means. Would have loved to have talked about that, but we didn't talk about it. So
we didn't talk about how in that scene Quentin Tarantino uses rear projection.
Right.
So it looks like it's a really fake, old-timey method. Like, it's clearly not real.
Yeah.
Like, why did he do that? You know, we didn't talk about that.
Right. Yeah. We also didn't talk about the fact that Quentin Tarantino wanted to use different music in the film, but he actually wasn't allowed to for really interesting reasons that we haven't been able to explain because we didn't talk about it.
We didn't talk about how they used Campbell's mushroom soup to do the white stuff that comes out of Uma Thurman's mouth.
Right.
Didn't talk about that.
That's good, yeah.
We didn't talk about Travolta hanging out with heroin addicts.
Oh, yeah. That would have been cool. We didn't talk about the fact that the studio didn't even like the script at the beginning. You know, I would have liked to have talked about that as well.
That's not true.
But we didn't talk about it.
That's not true. Who said? Where did you read that? Because that bit's not true. I would have.
If we'd talked about it, you would have been able to tell me it's not true. But but you can't now.
No,
because we haven't talked about it, so it doesn't. No. It doesn't matter.
Mm.
It doesn't matter that I think that's true. There's nothing you can do about it because we didn't talk about it. I know you really want to, because and I can feel that you're desperate to tell me that that's wrong. But I believe that's true because there hasn't been time for you to tell me that it's not.
We didn't talk about why at the beginning there's the freeze frame over Amanda Plummer's character.
Right.
When she says, any of you fucking pricks move and I'll execute every motherfucking last one of you.
Yeah.
It freezes
before the audio stops.
Before the audio stops. Great. And we didn't talk about why.
Yeah, but I bet I know why.
I
wish I could tell you.
Because
I noticed the difference later in the film.
No,
I can't tell you. No.
Joe, sorry for
I can't tell you and you can't tell me because we didn't talk about it, Adam. No.
The thing you think it is wrong.
No.
Okay,
no.
Okay.
You can't tell me about it. Because we also didn't talk about the fact that this is just a Wes Anderson film with the illusion of structure where it finishes where it started. And we could have talked about that for ages, but we didn't. So we can't talk about it because we didn't talk about it.
We didn't talk about also the scene where Vincent and Jules go to the kind of college boys, their room. That's a tasty burger.
Yeah.
We didn't talk about how that scene just really made me think the opening scene for Inglourious Basterds and how it's basically the same scene.
Right, yeah.
But we didn't talk about that.
No, and we didn't talk about the fact that there's kind of a prequel to it as well and some interweaving between a couple of different films, which is a shame because that would have been another fun conversation to have, but we didn't talk about it. So
yeah, the crossover characters, it didn't come up in conversation because I was reading quotes out from books and...
Do you think if we talked about all of those things, it would have been a better episode?
I think it would, yeah. It would have been certainly more comprehensive.
Yeah.
And it would have seemed like we would have added value to the pulp fiction oeuvre of critical thought. As it is, we didn't do that. You know, tasty, but of no consequence.
When was the last time you heard from your father?
Daddy. Oh yeah, the box office game. Yeah, I forgot about that. Right. Well, this is the film Pulp Fiction. That's right. It's the film Pulp Fiction. Released, of course, 1994, October 16. We'll come to that more specifically when we do opening weekend US and Canada. But Bouget, according to IMDb, brackets estimated for Pulp Fiction. Please, Adam.
Now, despite having the screenplay and having read lots of interviews,
I did wonder, have you come across this number before? Because it's the kind of number you probably would have come across before.
If I say the number and it's bang on, then yeah. I've probably come across it.
Okay.
It is second movie. I'm going to say, because I know Reservoir Dogs was made for 1.2 million.
Right.
I feel like Pulp Fiction was made for 8.
I think you've come across it somewhere.
Yeah, okay, it's 8. Yeah.
It was $8 million.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So yeah. I have come across that number.
Yeah, probably.
But so it's smack bang on 8.
It's smack bang on 8. I mean, there's not a digit out of place. So
okay.
You know, I think you've really hit the nail on the Pokemon there. It's you've evolved into a Charizard and you've set fire to everything around you. So you know, good job, well done. Whether that was buried in the subconscious or just a little underneath the blankets, we'll never know. Opening weekend US and Canada now. Maybe you've read about this. We'll find out. I doubt it'll be bang on because there's a few more digits involved in this one. There was only 2 in the last one, you know. There was 1-8 and then there was 6 zeros. And now, as I say that, I'm remembering that episode where you had forever been confused about the number of zeros after something. That was funny, wasn't it?
That was funny.
A fun episode.
That was good.
But what do you think about opening weekend US and Canada? October 16th, 1994. Fall is happening in America. It's fall, yeah? Actually, that's the week just before the Americans put their clocks back, isn't it? So I don't know if that will have impacted the cinema viewing at all, but probably not on the opening weekend, because the opening weekend, it still will have been the summertime.
Well, Weinstein, the release for strategy for this was fairly inspired. He called it the Iron Curtain strategy. They did one screening in Cannes where it got standing ovations and won the Palme d'Or, right. And then they didn't screen it again for a good couple of months, and the next screening was the New York Film Festival. So they've just really kind of kept it locked in about who saw this. There were certain film critics they wanted it to see, and just really built buzz, the anticipation and excitement for it as a result. And it's got Bruce Willis in it. It's got stars. It's the guy who directed Reservoir Dogs.
It's John Travolta from Grease.
Everyone is chatting about this. This is the movie. So what does a movie like this open like in 1994?
I mean, who the hell knows?
$15 million?
Not quite that much. It made $9.3 million, which, if you forget about the marketing, is more than the budget. I mean, it's the budget back. So, you know... I think that's a well done everyone involved, apart from Harvey Weinstein, of course, who can fuck off.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, let's move on to gross worldwide then, because, you know, did it run, I suppose? Was the pulp sufficiently wet and juicy to be formed into actual paper? Is that how paper works? I don't know. But how much money did this make?
Well, I know this made seriously boffo box office. It was referred to as the film that built Miramax, Miramax.
It's certainly
the house.
a catchy tag.
Here we go. Miramax was the house, the studio that Pulp Fiction built.
Right. You know,
the house that Pulp Fiction built.
That's what people have been saying. I'm always hearing people say that. That's the thing. I go outside and then as soon as I leave my front door, someone says, do you want to talk about postmodernism? And I say, sure, yeah. And they say, have you heard of the house that Miramax built? The studio that was built by the film of Miramax was Pulp Fiction? And I say, are you doing a postmodern thing now? And they say, no, I'm just trying to remember what they said. They said something about it.
Kevin
and then
Smith
you walk on and someone else says the same thing. They're all trying to remember what that thing was. And, you know, it's just a bunch of people outside, like that Spider-Man meme where they're all pointing at each other saying, catchy, it's catchy, catchy. That one's catchy. Catchy.
So I think I've also maybe subconsciously taken on this number. So if I get it bang on.
Uh-huh. Listen, if you get this bang on, I will give you the amount of money that you're about to tell me, okay?
Okay, I think it made I think it made $100 million.
I don't owe you any money.
Did it make 200?
It made 213 million, $928,762.
Yeah, that's That's why.
That's Boffo for an $8 million movie.
It's the house that it built. The house.
That's why it's the house that it built. The house.
Yeah, that's why it's built the house.
Yeah, yeah. Well done, everyone involved.
Except Harvey Weinstein. Sorry, I'll let you do that one.
No, that was good that we both said it at the same time.
Okay, so that was the Pulp Fiction episode. Shall we play the game where one of us tries to catch out the other one on a movie they forgot to pick our next episode?
I'd love to. And as I open my notepad, Adam, I'm reminded that I have the link in here for that Rotten Tomatoes 25 years thing that I keep forgetting to bring up. So we'll do it probably on next week's episode.
Keep promising it because we're not doing it now.
No, absolutely not. What I've realised is that I have yet again forgotten to add to my list. And so I'm just looking at a bit of a thin list here.
You know what happens if you don't home run me? We can go to the communal list finally.
That's right. I've only got 5 guesses to get you with. And if I don't get you, we might be finally going to the communal list. I have forgotten to refresh my list this week. So we're closer than ever to the communal list. We're touching cloth with the communal list, Adam. And it feels mighty fine to me. But I've still got to get through these guesses first. Okay, I'm going to start with one that... I think you're going to say no to it. But on the basis that... And it's not strictly animation. I mean, it's not animation in any sense at all, actually. It's puppetry. But I think you're going to say no to Team America.
Couldn't that be a Forgot You Forgot?
I mean, it's been a very long time since I've seen Team America.
Feels like there's so many memorable bits, and it's...
If it feels dishonest to you, that's okay.
I might let you leave it on the table. I don't particularly care about it, and certainly haven't watched it since I saw it at the cinema, which is like a million years ago.
No, that's fine. That's fine. Let's take it off the table then.
No, leave it on the table for a bit. I don't mind. Let's...
The table is where I leave things that I might bring back another episode, not today.
Let's see how you go. Maybe it's on the table for this run.
Okay. I don't know. All right, what about this one? Her.
Because I know you love this movie.
I do like this film.
I feel like you're using inside knowledge.
Am I?
Maybe you're not. How could
my
you?
My bucket is leaking. Yeah, if it is, if it's inside knowledge, it might be in there. But I'm channeling it right now without knowledge, without conscious knowledge.
I feel like we're going to get some. We'll get a little less stick than we will for Pulp Fiction, but we'll get a sizable amount of stick. I never rewatched Her.
Oh really?
No.
You saw it in the cinema.
Saw it in the cinema. Was pleasantly surprised, and then just thought like, yeah, it's a really good film, but like nothing. The aesthetic is quite memorable. Do you think it's a Forgot You Forgot, or do you just want us to do it?
Not really. I've sort of just said it because my list is pretty thin.
Should we leave that? Let's leave that on the table there.
We're leaving them all on the table. Yeah. The table's got some stuff on it.
I really want you to get me, you know.
I want to get you as well. But I'm looking at my list and thinking, I'm not going to get this guy.
Pull my pants down.
I just don't want to.
Pull my pants out. Bring out the gimp of your idea, yeah?
The gimp is Tom Cruise, and it's like, I don't know if I could be bothered to do another Tom Cruise.
Yeah. We'll just say the film until I can say no to it.
I've got a Tom on here. I've got a George on here. Right?
Oh, my God.
I've got a Tom and a George. Unfortunately, they've been in some forgettable stuff, and I think these are both dead center canon Forgot You Forgots. But I don't know if I'm up for... Who did we do most recently? Was it George? We did George most recently, was it? Clooney.
Yeah.
Of course, I mean for the audience, Clooney. All right, fine. I'll hit you. Who'd you... The Descendants. Or Collateral, you pick.
Oh, Collateral.
Yeah? This is the thing, I knew you were going to say Collateral, which is why I said The Descendants. Because I'd much rather rewatch The Descendants than I would rewatch Collateral. I feel like Collateral's... So how about this? a double bill of Collateral and The Descendants. It makes no sense, but that feels right for us.
Does it?
Yeah, sure. Why would anyone do that? It doesn't make any sense. That's why it's funny.
Okay, I suppose.
Clooney and Cruise. We've covered them both so much before anyway that it's like, imagine trying to compare and contrast those two films.
I feel like it's a really stupid idea. Why are we going to do that?
It is a stupid idea.
It's not fun. It's not going to be... these are long records anyway.
It might be funny now. It won't be funny next week.
Yeah, so let's not do that.
All right,
I'd like to do Collateral because I just watched Public Enemies, another of Michael Mann's forgotten movies.
Right, right, yeah, yeah.
I'm up on Mann.
Yeah, okay. So The Descendants then?
No, so we should do Collateral.
Oh, we're doing Collateral. Okay, we're doing Collateral, yeah.
Yeah, let's do Collateral because... Okay. I've never rewatched that film. I didn't like the aesthetic, but I rewatched Miami Vice recently. I've just watched Public Enemies, and the digital aesthetic that Mann used in that actually looks really good on my telly. And so I think
Michael Mann directed The Descendants.